Welcome to Real Deal Recovery, where the focus is topic-based and centered on physical and emotional recovery from drugs and alcohol or any other self-destructive behavior. Here's your host, Stephen Gerard.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Our guest today came up with a stellar topic that's long overdue. In fact, I've gotten some email in the past about this topic, and the topic that our guest came up with is outside addictions. You know, frequently when some alcoholics or addicts put down the drugs or alcohol, they pick up another habit that may not be too healthy for them. For example, some heroin addicts, when they put down the spoon, they have a tendency to pick up the fork. Our guest today, Ion, he's been clean and sober for 22 years. He brings some reliable experience to the table. Ion, welcome to Real Deal Recovery.
Hi, Stephen. How are you today?
I'm great. So glad you could make it over this afternoon. Could you start us off by taking us through your last year of using and how you hit bottom and a little bit about your first step?
Well, my last year of using, I was very resistant to the program because I had some years of abstinence and I never really clicked with the program, got stuck on the second step, was able to maintain abstinence for another almost 4 years after that. And my life was insane, and I wound up, my life was better for me if I did pick up, which I eventually did. And things were good for a couple of years. And then the third year they started, you know, the arrests started happening, the firing started happening, the on and off toxic relationship was more off than on. And then, when it was off, I got really depressed. And the using wasn't working for me anymore, and a good friend of mine, who was an excellent using buddy, we were the Bonnie and Clyde of Scottsdale, she violated probation and had to do a little bit on house arrest, and she called me up and she said, hey, can you give me a ride to a meeting? So I gave her a ride to a meeting, and I was loaded at the time, and She asked if I wanted to come in, and I said, no, I tried that, I can't deal with some of the steps. They're just, they're hard. And so I picked her up after the meeting, and she said, listen, there's a guy in there, and he's bugging me. You got to talk to him. I said, okay. So the next day I went to a meeting because, you know, I was going to get to kick somebody's ass. I mean, this was what I like to do. And I went to the meeting, and I was loaded. It was a crystal meth day. And I was able to fill up everybody's coffee in the room. It was a huge room, about 100 people. It took me about 2 minutes, and I didn't spill a drop. I don't think my feet hit the ground. So everybody was kind of laughing because they knew I was loaded. And, I said to my friend, I'm like, hey, where's this guy? She's like, oh, he didn't come today. Maybe he'll be here tomorrow. Well, to shorten up the anecdote, it took about 2 weeks till I figured out that I was bamboozled and there was no guy. And she was just trying to get me to go to meetings. And it did work because I wasn't going to meetings loaded. I was waiting till later in the day. It was a 5:30 meeting. I was waiting till nighttime to get loaded. But then I was so pissed, I actually bought her a car and said, you give yourself a ride to meetings. And that was, she got sober about 13 months, maybe about 11 months before I did. And, without my running mate, things got very chaotic. And my last year of using, I didn't want to live anymore. I just couldn't. I couldn't die, and I couldn't find somebody to shoot straight enough to put me out of my misery. You know, I pissed off some very, very bad people, and they just couldn't get the job done. And it was miserable. You know, the cases were starting to mount up, and then I was doing some things that being blamed for doing some things I don't even remember doing. And it was later explained to me that somebody had taken my identity and was also being a criminal like myself with my name, so it made sense once my head cleared that, yeah, you did a lot of stuff that you don't remember because I really didn't do it, but there was plenty of stuff I did do. And, I just omnipotent stuff like a car of mine would get stolen, and it would get, you know, they'd crash it into a police car or a school bus. And, you know, luckily, you know, they happened at different sides of town, but around the same time. So the police knew that it couldn't have been me. And one night, I was in the motorcycle business, had a nice little motorcycle shop in a junkyard and a car lot, and just picked up this really nice Lincoln for $400, but it had a problem starting. And I'm on my way home, and I didn't want to turn the car off, but I need to stop at 7-Eleven, Circle K, one of those convenience stores, and pick up something. And anyway, I didn't turn the car off, and of course, while I'm waiting in line, somebody steals the car. Well, I know I better report the car stolen before it gets run into something. So I call the police, report the car stolen, they run my name. There's a warrant for me out in this suburb of Phoenix that I don't even remember being in, let alone being arrested in. So they arrest me on the warrant to take me back to the station, and we get everything figured out. They send a mugshot over, and it's not me, and they're like, okay, somebody's definitely using your name, and we'll get on it. We'll get the judge to quash the warrant, and we'll get you right home. Where are you going? And I gave him my address, and somebody just said, we can't give you a ride home there. I'm like, well, why not? He's like, well, it's a crime scene. And somehow my house had kind of blown up. And I'm, you know, I go there, and the story I later found out, I didn't know why it got blown up. Of course, the newspapers thought it was a meth lab, but I'd actually pissed off one group of white supremacists and a motorcycle gang at the same time. And I guess from what the police told me was the white supremacists booby-trapped my house. And when the bikers came to rob me, they set off the booby trap, which did some damage to the biker gang as well as my home. And this was in a particular part of town that was a little rough, and it wasn't like my primary residence, but it was where I would hang out after work. So, so that car getting stolen actually probably saved my life. And that warrant that somebody else used my name saved my life. And I started seeing things in a different manner that you know, I'm just not going to die. That's not my calling. And that wasn't my path. And got out of a couple other situations, and finally they arrested me for my own good. You know, you have one self-defense shooting, okay, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. You have a second self-defense shooting, well, maybe you're doing something we should look into. And, you know, the third self-defense shooting, they were just going to lock me up and throw away the key so nobody would shoot at me anymore. And that's basically what happened. And I woke up in jail again. And, you know, there's four guys shooting at me, and they couldn't hit me. And two guys shot each other. They blamed that on me. Two guys got into a car they stole from me a week earlier. They crashed into a police car. They blamed that on me. And, you know, I finally said, I'm not going to die, so I might as well quit using. About a week later, I was still in jail. And it was the first time I ever heard the word no bail. I was always able to buy myself out of trouble. And they just said, there ain't enough money in the world to let you out, son. And I had plenty of cash at the time still. And, you know, they just said, we're not going to let you out. You know, some people, their lives change if, you know, somebody says I'm pregnant or you're fired or I do. With me, it was no bail. And they sent me down to this county jail in Florence, which was built in like the 1800s. It was an old territorial jail. And, you know, I got to work in the kitchen, and got to hang out there a while. And it's funny, see, in Phoenix, in Maricopa County, they have this sheriff that's a complete egomaniacal maniac, and he actually, there was a problem with the inmates stealing white boxer shorts. So they would give everybody pink boxers, hoping they wouldn't steal them. Now, of course, they made a ton of money selling the pink boxers at Christmas time, and it was a marketing ploy, but I was over in the other county where they give you your underwear back. So I spent a week in the pink boxers, and I had these smuggling underwear on, and I had an eight ball of meth in my smuggling underwear. And I didn't even realize that I had it. And so a week after this whole incident, I was the last time I used meth. I kind of ate most of it just so I wouldn't get caught in it. And, you know, of course, there's other guys that were there, and they helped themselves, and that's fine and whatever. I did not deliver it to them. They took it. Any legals out of there. So, you know, at about 30 days after this, OJ gets acquitted of two murders simultaneously while I'm being denied bail again. So I figure if he could kill two people and go home, and I'm stuck here with these yo-yos, I really have to start making some changes in my life. You know, ask for a big book, then get it. You know, I had already kind of eased back into meetings from my friend, and she was doing phenomenal being sober. So she was a really good inspiration. And, you know, they made a deal with me. I could do 9 months or I could go to treatment. So I went to Sierra Tucson and ran into a couple of friends there and ran into some really great people. And, you know, there was a guy that I kind of looked up to as another musician. And he was breaking out of there, and he wanted a few people to go with. And I just decided not to go with and to stay. And I met this guy from New York, walrus mustache, very muscular, you know, tan. You know, my... is it okay to swear in here?
Sure, we'll just put an explicit in the notes.
All right, well, then I won't swear. But, okay. But he was a jerk, but he was my kind of jerk. I could relate to him. And we're talking, and he's like, you know, did you ever try and get sober before? And I'm like, yeah, well, I did. And he's like, oh, let me guess. You got stuck on a step. You stopped going to meetings, stopped talking to your sponsors, stopped reading the literature from the program, stopped talking to other alcoholics and addicts, and eventually your life got so crazy, you were better off picking up. And I'm like, you know, this guy, he figured me, he knows me better than I know myself. And, you know, I kind of, you know, as usual, my instinct is to get pessimistic and resentful. It's like, why are you here? And he's like, well, I've been sober, clean and sober for over 15 years, but, you know, I got the secretary that I really love. She's like half my age, and my wife found out, and she wants a divorce, and, you know, she's entitled to like half of everything I have. And I'm like, well, how much do you have? He's like, well, $4 million. And I'm like, well, so let me get this straight. You have this other girl that you love more. You get to be with somebody that's half your age that makes you feel young again and makes you happy and makes you gleeful. And you get $2 million. And he's just like, you know, I never really looked at it like that. I'm not that depressed anymore. And you know, I can't believe nobody ever brought that up to him. But, you know, here I am 3-4 days out of jail. And, you know, I'm already helping another addict. But this guy, he pegged me down. And we've kept in touch through the years. And, you know, I stayed in treatment. I listened. I learned. Met a core group of friends, and eventually was released out to house arrest, awaiting several trials, not only my violation that landed me in jail, but some new charges. And, you know, I was on house arrest. The only thing they'd let me out of the house for was meetings. I go to 5 meetings a day. Some were right by my house, and some were 30, 40 miles away from my house, so I can, you know, do whatever I had to do on the way home. And, you know, I still had tremendous denial. I didn't, you know, went back and forth between the first step and the third tradition. You know, did I really want to quit? Well, I'm going to have to quit if I'm going to keep from going to prison the rest of my life. You know, was I really an addict, or just was I a hard partier with mental problems and bad luck with the cops? You know, I mean, that flip-flopped, and there was so much stuff going on my first year of being clean and sober that, you know, life got so much easier to handle after just 8-9 months in recovery and being clean and sober. You know, the toxic relationships didn't bother me anymore. the financial problems were being handled, the legal problems were, you know, they weren't great, but they were better than they were when I first got out. And I was losing a lot of opportunities. You know, the state licensed you for everything here. I was losing a lot of my licenses, and, you know, okay, I'm going to have to find something else to do for work for a while. And I finally, at like 10 months sober, I admitted to my innermost self that I was, in fact, an alcoholic, and I couldn't drink the way that I used to, or the way that I wanted to, or even the way that other people did. And I was okay with that. And life just got so much easier that the cravings, I wouldn't say went away altogether, but they became a lot less. And, you know, there were certain triggers, like I had to park my motorcycle at my uncle's house in Tucson. Because, you know, one night I'd get that feeling and I'd want to run. You know, I may not have wanted to use, but I definitely wanted to violate my house arrest. And we found out who had taken my identity. And we blamed about 99% of the stuff that I was facing on him, because he had died. They actually dragged me out of rehab when they found his body, because they thought he was me. So we blamed the dead guy, and he did do 85% of it, so I'm not that upset about it. But, you know, somebody killed him. And I was jealous at first because I was so miserable. And then I felt really bad for the guy. You know, he was a father, he was a son, he was a brother. And he was an ex-con, and it was somebody else that this disease took out.
Now, you've been clean and sober for quite a while now. How did you come up with this topic?
Well, I'm an action junkie. I'm a deal junkie. You know, I love doing deals. You know, I'm a real estate broker today, which helps me get my deal fix going. But before then, it was cars, motorcycles, guitars, guns, drugs, whatever I could deal with.
You like that adrenaline?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I was on house arrest, I used to sell, exotic dancer clothes just to give me an excuse to go to the exotic dancer clubs during the day. It was weird. When I first got sober, I didn't really need to work that hard. But the money ran out pretty quick. You know, you make some amends to the IRS and some people that you owe, and next thing you know, your retirement's over.
How have the steps helped you along the way to
address this? Oh, absolutely.
How specifically have
absolutely.
They helped you?
Absolutely. Well, you know, when that guy called me out in rehab about getting stuck on the second step, you know, I got a sponsor, and I said, listen, I have a lot of trouble with God. I'm very angry with God. I lost my mom at a young age. You know, I mean, my dream was to be starting center of the Chicago Bulls, and I topped out at 5'7", and that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, Santa Claus wasn't real, and I was angry with God. And it was plain to me, well, the God you grew up with, you can have a new God. And my sponsor said, listen, if you have a problem visualizing the concept of God, he's like, use an inanimate object. Use your house plan. And, of course, at 90 days sober, the house plant that I used to puke and pee on because I couldn't make it to the bathroom coming in, at 90 days sober, the thing came up and died. And I start treating it nice, and it dies. And I told my sponsor, I'm like, you won't believe this, that the house plant died. He's like, yeah, it's an Al-Anon plant. And that kind of hit me, and I struggled. I mean, I used Elvis, and then True Romance came out. Hey, it's a guy that talks to Elvis that rips off drug dealers, and I'm just like, oh, that's too close to home. So Darth Vader, the Force, Santa Claus, I was dating this little goth girl, and she was she worshiped Satan. And which, you know, everyone's like, ooh, Satan. It kind of opened my mind up to organized religion again, because the religion I grew up with, I wasn't too hip on, but it's the religion I am today, if you consider me religious. But I had no idea what they were planning with that goat, and I didn't want to know. So I had to kick her to the curb. And You know, the higher power that keeps me clean today is probably somewhere between Marilyn Monroe and Marilyn Manson. And it's been working, and I have different higher powers today. Money is a huge higher power. It motivates me to get out of bed and go to work. Women, another higher power. Cars, I mean, if I could date some cars, that would make my life so much simpler, but I can't. So I know I worship different things that can very easily become a problem.
When a lot of people are in their early recovery, not necessarily just the early recoveries, they go along, oftentimes they find other addictions taking over that might not be that healthy for them. What's your take on applying the steps to these other addictions and seeking outside help?
Well, I remember reading in the Big Book, when we found it necessary, we sought professional help. Now, the first time I read that, I actually thought it referred to Asian massage. I later realized that it was to psychiatric. My sober addictions, I watch very carefully. I mean, there's times where I will gamble before all my bills and amends are paid. There's times I shop when I really don't need anything. I definitely eat when I'm not hungry. If I'm not eating, shopping, or gambling, I'm usually thinking about sex. When I was younger, it was definitely obsessing about sex. Now that I've hit the last half century, that's slowed down a little bit. But
in the Big Book, it mentions, when problems with sex arise, to throw yourself into working with newcomers maybe a little bit more seriously. What's your take on working with others and how that helps you with your emotional sobriety? Well,
I think it completely takes you out of yourself. And what's ever going on with you kind of loses that false priority, for lack of a better word. I mean, I know all my problems today are luxury problems, but it doesn't mean they're not problems.
And could you give us a specific example of when you were going through a rough patch and working with another helped you?
Breakups, usually through breakups, that totally takes my mind off of myself. And sometimes I find sponsees that also have the same problems as me. Like, to me, going to the casino and playing poker all night is not an answer. It did help me my first major surgery and recovery and with the pills. Playing poker all night did detox me. I knew that I wasn't in pain anymore, but I knew it was time to take a pill. So I did go to the casino and play poker till dawn, and I felt much better, and I wound up cleaning up and going to work that day, and everything was fine after that. Have I gone and played poker on work nights where I shouldn't be out all night? Of course. So to me, dragging, the casino is, there's some really hurting people at the casino. And somehow it gives me gratitude that I don't have to be there 24/7 hitting the button to spin the wheel on the slot machine. I would much rather, have a cup of coffee till 2 a.m. with a newcomer, helping them off the ledge.
Thanks so much for showing up for this podcast today. It's been great. And have a super holiday.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Stephen. I appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for keeping me and hopefully a few other people sober this last hour.
Stephen Gerard is available for sober coaching and consulting by visiting SoberCoachNYC.com, offering additional support, guidance, and motivation for people in all phases of recovery. Just visit SoberCoachNYC.com. That's SoberCoachNYC.com to set up a complimentary life-changing discussion. Make a decision to change your life.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you find this content of value and you'd like to have the podcast delivered directly to your device, please rate, review, and subscribe over on iTunes. This way, each new pod will be delivered directly to you and you won't have to go looking for it. We have some new blogs that may be of interest to you, and you can find those over at www.realdealrecoverypod.com. If you'd like to get a hold of me for any reason, or you'd like to suggest a topic, or if you have any questions pertaining to recovery, you can reach me directly at realdealrecoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's realdealrecoverypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for tuning in. And remember, recovery is not a spectator sport. Get in the ring.